the Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to the new year for Lifetime Income. We have a lot of things to talk about on the show today. We'll have some special guests coming up in the weeks ahead, and this is the beginning of the year. Time to get into financial shape.
And I'm John Leffler. Happy New Year to everyone, a belated one. Our special guest on the program today is attorney Elizabeth McCoy, and the subject is our special needs trust. That's a very important issue because in a lot of cases, things may arise where you will need special care or other issues financially as well as other considerations, and these will be different than most people would plan for. That time of year, New Year's resolutions, I never make them since I just try to live them all year long and say, what do we need to be doing? And let's get on with it. Don't wait till the New Year's. I found New Year's resolutions last about 3 days or until the first 2 pounds you gain during the holiday season wear off, something along those lines. But what we're going to do on today's show is focus on getting into financial shape. We'll focus on your financial health, whether you're heading into retirement, whether you're retired, or just starting out. What do you need to know? What's really interesting is that the millennials, by the way, certain groups of the millennial groups, having come through the recession as the first part of their economic life, are now getting very, very concerned about savings and planning for financial success in the future, which I would say is a real plus. Anyway, that's it, Jim. That's where we're focused. But you have to realize that 70% of Americans, as we have discussed before, have no retirement plan.
John, it's actually probably a lot worse than that. According to a recent survey that was done by Fidelity, this I find rather interesting. Only 31% of Americans are considering some kind of financial resolution this year, and that's down from 43% in 2014. So basically, the survey is saying that less Americans are planning any kind of financial resolutions whatsoever or making any resolutions. And John, this is going to be really important because in an era where we see today with financial repression, we've had two bear markets in, let's say, the last decade. We've got 0% interest rates. Actually, interest rates have fallen. We're almost back to where we were back in 2013 when interest rates bottomed on the 10-year Treasury note at 1.6%. We're actually below 2%. Which is going to make it more important that individuals have a plan, start early for retirement, because it's going to become more critical.
So what you're talking about then is starting early. You need to make this a habit, part of your life and thinking. You have to spend less than you make. You have to put money aside, starting from an early age rather than a crisis situation much later on. Unfortunately, many Americans don't think long term, and they have so many competing interests. And let's face it, so many people, when you're starting out in life, have a lot of things pitched at you and they want to do things and they're getting married or whatever it happens to be they're into. There is a propensity to consume and to encumber oneself with a lot of debt.
And, you know, this is something that we're seeing a lot of, and we've talked about it on previous programs. We'll be doing some education programs this year, where one of the reasons, you know, economists have been puzzled on the real estate market, why we haven't seen new household formations. And part of it, John, is for one reason, student loan debts. You have a husband and wife getting married. They could be bringing anywhere from $70,000 to $100,000 of debt into the marriage to begin with. But you know, the one thing that you talked about is there is this propensity to save. And most Americans during their working career, let's say you get out of school, get out of college, will spend 40 to 45 years of their lifetime working, probably closer to 45 years today as one of the trends that we're finding in retirement. People are working longer, waiting longer to retire because they can get full Social Security benefits. There are a number of reasons, or they're working part-time. But the key thing here, I'm going to show you some numbers, folks, and I want you to just get the gist of what I'm saying here, because this is going to be powerful. By starting out early, it helps, because in the long run, according to Jeremy Siegel, he talks about this constant total return in the stock market above inflation has been about 6.8%. So let's just say that you're starting out your working career today and you want to have, let's just make this easy, just say you want to have $1 million when you retire. And for most of you, that's going to be age 66 or age 67 when you're going to get full Social Security benefits, and may even be older if they do some Social Security reform and move that retirement age and extend it even further. So the key point I'm trying to make here is if you want to have $1 million when you retire, if you start now and work for 45 years, all you would have to do is put away $3,700, actually $715, basically $310 a month. If you wait to 40 years and you contribute, so let's say you wait to 5 years after you get out of college, you would have to put aside $5,273, or roughly $440 a month. You start only 30 years away from retirement, the number doubles to $10,973, that's $915 a month. 20 years before you retire, the number more than doubles, goes up to about $25,000. You're going to have to save almost $2,100 a month. And in 10 years before you retire, here's a big one, $73,000, or almost $6,000 a month. So you can see there that basically, the sooner you start, the less money you have to put aside. Now I'm going to show you, if you think about it, how everybody can have $1 million when they retire. Now let's take somebody that wants to start out. Let's say you're out of college. You're probably going to work 45 years during your working career. So you need to put aside about $310 a month. Well, the most logical place to put that would be in a 401k program at work. Because number one, you're going to get a tax deduction for doing it. Number two, your income or any gains you have, interest and dividends, are going to grow tax deferred. And let me put this into perspective. Okay, I mentioned the figure $300. It actually is only $60. In many programs today, the employer has a matching contribution, usually on the first 3%, first 4% of your income. So on $300, it's very well that the employer could put $150 of the $300 you need to save. Secondly, if you're like most Americans, you're probably between federal and state tax bracket, you're probably in a 30% tax bracket working. That means $90 you're going to save on that $300 from tax deductions. So let's take the $150 matching contribution from your employer, $90 in tax savings, that comes to $240. So on that $300 you would need to put away for the next 45 years, $300 a month, roughly, it's only going to cost you $60. Your employer's picking up matching contributions, $150. The government's kicking in with tax savings and $90. How many of you today, starting out in life, could give up maybe going out to dinner once a month and save $60? Because that's really what it's going to cost you net out of pocket to meet that $300 a month. It's absolutely amazing that we don't see more and more Americans doing this. They could all end up being millionaires. And I think, John, this is just a situation of somebody sitting down and explaining mathematically the finances of how this works. This is not magic. It's time and compounding.
Right. I don't think people ever think it through at that level. I mean, as you describe those numbers to me, you go, well, gee, that's pretty easy. I never thought of that before. You know, when you say we have to make $1 million, people will sit and go, how am I going to do that? I can barely pay this. I can barely do that. But let's get back to resolutions, beginning of the year. When surveys and polls are given, what do they say about the most popular resolutions that people make at the beginning of the year? What are the top, let's say, what, three or four, something like that?
Well, here is an area where there is consistency in the polls that they're doing. I mean, less Americans plan on making a New Year's financial resolution this year than the previous year, down by 28%. However, those that do, there is some consistency in terms of priority, in terms of what they are. Number one at the top of the list is save more, about 55% of respondents to the survey. And this was done, by the way, by Fidelity Investments, a major survey. In fact, just looking at males represented 49% of the survey. This was a sample of over 2,000 households, females 51%. The average age was 46. Average income was roughly about $56,000 a year, 57% employed. And graduate school, 13%, at college, 43%, high school or less, 42%. So a pretty broad sampling of the country. So number one at the top of the list, save more, 55%. Number two, pay off debt. That was about 20%. Number three, spend less. That was about 17%, which would make sense. If you want to save more and you want to pay down debt, well, obviously you're going to have to spend less. So of those planning to save more, the survey said they want to increase their savings by almost $200 a month. And remember, folks, that's not hard to do if you're doing it with a 401k or the company's matching contributions, and you also have tax savings. And this is, by the way, an increase from the previous 2 years. That's up to 14% that want to increase their savings. That's up from 6% in 2011. The most popular long-term goals, and I'm glad to see this because that's what this show is all about, is save for retirement. And most of them responding say that they plan on doing that either one through, let's say, setting up an individual IRA, Roth or otherwise, or a 401k program at work. Some of the most short-term popular goals, having an emergency fund, 52%, saving for a car, 39%, paying down credit cards, especially those 18 and 20% interest rates, 38%, and saving for a home, 35%. So some very logical goals there and some consistency. And the good thing here is, you know, to see a lot more people thinking of, hey, a long-term goal, saving for retirement.
Those are general topics that people make resolutions about. Anything else that stands out that people tend to highlight? Maybe these are generational issues. Maybe they're otherwise.
You know, it was interesting because some of the other findings, you know, the number one finding was there's less Americans planning on making financial resolutions, down by 38%. I found that rather surprising, given the Financial Times and what the country's gone through here in the last probably 5 or 6 years. Number two finding, despite the decline in financial resolutions, more Americans are increasingly feeling better about their finances. And John, here's where you see a generational one. And I think this has a lot to do with, let's say, financial repression. Generation Y, 50% feel better about their finances. Gen Xers, 41%. Baby boomers, 35%. Seniors, 28%. And I think a big reason for that, John, is what's happened to interest rates. You know, I've often given this example on the program, but, you know, we go back to the year 2000, it would only take roughly about $500,000 to get you a monthly income of $3,000. Today, it takes $8 million to get the same amount in a safe investment. So a lot of seniors are feeling the pinch of lower bank CDs, lower money market funds, and lower interest rates in general. Even if you look at the bond market, we've got sovereign bond yields that are below 2%. I did an interview this week where we talked about that. I mean, Swiss government bonds are 16 basis points. That's less than 0.2%. And so it's amazing that you can see that generational divide there. The third finding is, be warned, making resolutions may improve your financial condition. 51% now say they feel better off financially. In contrast, only 38% of those who did not say the same. So it's basically what a lot of people have found. Once you make these financial resolutions, they're pretty easy to kind of stick to. 74% say they realized at least 50% of their financial goal resolutions, versus, let's say, 29% the year before. And finally, the fourth thing that they found in the survey is you, yes, you, the listener, are the most powerful motivator. And most people say that it's easy to stick to these financial resolutions, and the most effective motivator really is simply your own willpower. John, I forget, is it 21 days? You do something for 21 days, you turn it into a habit.
I had never heard of that. I mean, but obviously, if you start to do it, they call it muscle memory in certain sports, and you do it, and then you just continue to do it.
Yeah, I think the figure is like 31%. It all of a sudden becomes habit forming. But those were probably some of the best things about the result that they found. You know, the bad news is fewer Americans are making financial resolutions. The good news is Americans are feeling more confident about their financial future, especially the younger generations. That's very strong. The third finding is that many people find once you make these resolutions, it's really easy to follow through. And it just takes a little willpower, which is your own self being the motivator.
So there we have talked about the importance of planning and starting early. I mean, starting early gives you a greater degree of success because you have a wider window, so to speak, to maneuver as circumstances change and make alternative plans. You need to pull together a plan. That should be the New Year's resolution. Let's move on to practical resolutions that you want to keep starting in 2015, getting into financial shape. Let's try that one.
Well, I mean, the first resolution is at the top of the list, and it just makes common sense. And this was very popular in terms of some of the goals, and that is set up an emergency fund. You know, I've been doing financial planning now for over 3 decades. And John, one of the rule of thumb that we've often mentioned is you should have 3 to 6 months worth of living expense in a bank account. There's always that unexpected emergency. You know, you need new tires for the car. You need a new battery. Maybe you have a high deductible on your medical insurance. You get sick. You have to come out of out-of-pocket money. And I also say that if you're self-employed, we usually recommend 1 year because you know what it's like in your own business. It could be cyclical. The economy can turn down. If you're self-employed, 1 year's worth of living expense. And you never know what the unexpected is going to be. It could be a job layoff. Think of how high the unemployment rate got in the last recession and how persistently that unemployment rate remained. I mean, it wasn't until roughly when the Fed started QE3 that we really started to see the unemployment rate come down. Some people are working today. Maybe they're not making as much as they used to. Job layoff, car expenses, medical illness is a big one. A lot of employers today, in order to maintain medical insurance for employees, are raising the deductible. Heck, if you come in under Obamacare, I got bad news for you. You know, the deductible is $5,000, even though it's going to cost you a fortune, twice as expensive. You know, you're going to have to go through $5,000 of your own money before it kicks in. So having a medical or emergency fund is probably right at the top of the list, is probably the number one sort of financial resolution you want to make.
Well, that just makes common sense. It gets you in the habit of savings, that it's a part of what you need to be doing. What about paying down debt? We hear these horror stories about students graduating from college with just hideous amounts of debt, and that's what millennials are going to have to tackle, but it's not their problem only.
No, and that was the second most important goal, which is paying down debt, especially credit cards. When you think of, you know, depending on also if you're late on your credit card payments, you could be paying anywhere from 12% all the way to over 20%. And another worthwhile goal is create multiple income streams. If you're young, maybe you want to get a side job. Maybe if you're a baby boomer, you use your investments. Create a dividend stream. That's why I love dividend paying stocks. Create a multiple income source. Maybe you get a part-time job. And what does that do for you? Number one, it helps increase savings. Number two, it helps you pay down debt. And also having that extra savings fund is just nice to know that you have a cushion there. And it's very effective when you're young and you have the energies that you can actually do something part-time. I know several of my clients have kids who are, in order to make it and to get ahead, are actually between a husband and wife. One of them has a second part-time job that they're doing to bring in that extra income. And you never know. Also, if you're nearing retirement, or let's say you are in retirement, working part-time. Heck, I've got doctors as clients that are retired that are working part-time, so that they can allow their IRAs to build up to age 70. They're holding off taking Social Security, so their Social Security checks are growing by 9% a year. If you don't take your Social Security at full retirement age at age 66, if you defer taking that, it's going to grow roughly by 8 or 9% a year. So you can even have a bigger Social Security check when you retire at age 70.
Well, one goal most definitely has to be there. It's a French word, budget. We say budget.
Budget.
You have to keep your
budget. I didn't
know
that was actually a French word.
I don't think the French even know it's a French word.
No, you got a special handle on the French language.
You know, but what's really important is when you establish this budget, this budget, it's a very effective means of achieving savings and paying down debt, because what it keeps you from doing is some months, if you keep tending to run over, then obviously the money put into savings or to pay down the debt simply isn't there. So the budget seems to be an important part.
Well, I mean, you're not going to get to establishing an emergency fund, savings, or paying down debt without a budget, because how do you do it? I mean, without knowing where your money is going, I mean, you obviously probably know what you're bringing in on your paycheck, but if you don't know where the money's going, taking a look at your checkbook or not having a budget, you know, how are you going to establish those goals of increasing savings, emergency fund, or paying down debt? So definitely having a budget. And most definitely, I think having a financial plan, it keeps you focused. It helps in the way of increasing your savings to reach that goal, paying down debt. It also helps you to prioritize those goals in terms of importance, because we all have different financial goals. And that's one of the things the survey talked about. You may have 5, 10 financial goals that you want to accomplish. You know, if you achieve half of them, you get a good feeling you're accomplishing something. And that's why you want to prioritize your goals. And having a plan, having a budget, it just makes it a lot easier if you know where your money's going, which most people don't. And all of a sudden, they get themselves into financial trouble at the end of the month. Another financial goal, John, and I think this is an important one, and it's often not talked about, and that is bringing your spouse into the financial decision. Too often, one spouse in a marriage or a partnership makes the financial decision. And you may have two different risk tolerances. You may have two different objectives. Maybe the husband wants to save for a new car, wife wants a new home or save for a home. Maybe one wants a college education, one wants retirement. And we really see this in the retirement market quite frequently, where you had maybe one spouse, maybe the husband, main breadwinner, made the financial decisions, even made the investment decisions, and all of a sudden he passes away. What does the wife do? The wife is left maybe not fully cognizant of everything, doesn't understand the financial markets. And that's why I think bringing both spouse and discussing this makes it so much easier. And then here's one that you don't often hear about, but this is part of the planning process. It's part of the budgeting process, setting up files. This is very important. Know where your investment statements, your 401k statements go. Setting up things for itemized deductions for filing your tax returns. And yes, folks, it is that time around the year. That's what you're going to be thinking about here in the next 90 days, because come April 15th, you're going to have to be filing your income tax returns. Knowing where your assets are. Knowing, for example, your insurance, what your insurance benefits are, life insurance, disability, home insurance, auto insurance. Know where these things are, because you really need to know this, because, you know, what happens if you have a spouse that passes away? You don't know where the estate planning of documents, or even worse, you don't have them. So there's some other things about being organized, and also communication between both spouses, I think, is really important and often not discussed as often as it should be.
You know, I remember in 2007 when you had to evacuate during the fires in San Diego. My mother had to in 2003 in San Bernardino. And there are other issues. We live in fire country here in the Pacific Northwest.
In the Pacific Northwest, as much as it rains?
Absolutely. In the summertime. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you remember, in 1910, the year of the great fires that wiped out a huge part of Idaho and Montana, which started much of the U.S. Forest Service's attitude towards fire control. But in the summertime, our fire danger goes very, very high. You're living in the woods, and, you know, these things can take off just as badly as a brush fire. And the point is, what happens if you have to evacuate suddenly? Some people recommend, say, for example, putting all of your critical documents in PDF files and putting them on a flash drive, and you carry it on your keychain. And so everything's scanned in and it's contained there. You carry a critical papers file, which I have, so that if you have to go in a hurry, you just grab these, say, throw those in the car. You've got everything that you need. You need to know the essential things that you must take, because usually you have a very short amount of time to do this. This seems more and more important today, especially security and keeping things together with financial hackers into corporate systems, having written records of everything that's important is really very, very important. It's interesting how few people seem to keep control of their documents, even their driver's licenses and things of that nature. A friend of mine, I have to constantly keep saying, keep control of your wallet, because he's always leaving it somewhere.
You know, this was something that really struck home with us. Now, if you live in Southern California, we get brownouts when we overuse energy, for example, and when we get these heat waves that we call Santa Anas, or high pressure systems that come through here. So, John, you know, I can remember in 1999, day the Fed was meeting and Greenspan was starting to raise interest rates, which eventually took us into the recession that began at the end of 2000. But we had a power out. Our zone was locked out of power for 4 hours. And here are the Fed's meeting. I can remember going out in the parking lot, turning on my radio to find out what the Fed did. So we've had these repeatedly. And I'm trying to think what year was. There was a power station that was knocked out on the border between California and Arizona. And literally the entire lights of San Diego were out for almost four and a half hours. And so these were things that we began preparation for. So we had a backup plan if the power went out. We have actually three backup plans. And we also put together, we have a file. It's like a plastic. Oh, you can get these at the Container Store, that we have all of our important documents. And John, this really came in handy in 2007, because most of the disasters, you live in Southern California, okay, you get an earthquake and, you know, the house shakes a little bit. But, you know, other than that, most of the serious earthquakes are north of San Diego, although Easter Sunday, 2010, I'll tell you, that was one that got my attention. This thing rattled for over a minute. That's the first time I saw my pool turning into a wave machine. But mainly the disasters that, you know, I've lived in San Diego for over 3 decades now. But most of the disasters, you know, hurricanes were on the East Coast, or typhoons were in Asia, tornadoes Midwest, East Coast, you know, severe winter storms, you know, volcanoes were always something that happened someplace else. Until 2004, we had a fire. 2007, they had to evacuate over 600,000 people in the city of San Diego. And that's where, John, having a backup plan really came in handy, and especially your valuable papers, your estate documents, your investment statements. And folks, this is going to be very important too, investment statements. Think of financial institutions or even the government or Sony Pictures, where you got hackers going in and everything is going to the cloud. Think about that for a moment. All your most valuable information is out there in the cloud somewhere. What happens if that information, wherever it's stored, is hacked? Think about that. Another good reason to have paper backup in an organized file.
I thought you were going to say for a minute there, San Diego suddenly had a volcano. Because you were talking about.
Well, we've got some mountains here, but I'm not aware of any volcanic activity, at least in the last couple zillion years here. Although, in the 60s, we did have a tsunami, believe it or not.
You mean along the shore there, yeah.
Yeah, in Coronado. Who would have thought?
Yeah, I thought maybe that Tommy Lee Jones movie about the volcano in Los Angeles had come true. All right, anything else in top resolutions, things that we need to examine?
You know, I think one of the easiest things to do to become successful and make it habit forming is to put your spending and savings on autopilot. You can put your savings on autopilot by having money deducted from your paycheck every month for your 401k program. So you never see it. It's taken out. Therefore, you've established a savings plan. Another thing is automatic bill paying that takes place is another way that can work very effectively, because that way you know your bills are taken, and you better know that your bills are paid like that, because if you don't look at it, how are you going to know, you know, what you have in your checkbook to spend? So putting your spending and your savings on autopilot increases the odds that you're going to be successful. And especially if you start doing this at an early age, make savings a habit and make spending less a habit.
So if you were to prioritize goals, I would say listing them is most important. List your top five, because most individuals follow difficult to follow, especially if it's not written down in format. I think we went through about 10 here today that we've talked about on the show. The fact that you set goals puts you way ahead, because then you know what you're trying to achieve. There's a reference point in the midst of all the ups and downs of life. And as you cited, most Americans, less than 30% of them, they don't have financial resolutions and they don't have retirement plans, 70% of Americans. So if you were to look down the top five, what would they be?
I would probably say number one, which just makes a logical sense, have a plan, have a budget. I mean, the other things, emergency funds, paying down debt, you're not going to be able to do that if you don't have a budget or have a plan. So number one at the top of the list, have a plan. Number two, have an emergency fund. It doesn't do you any good to put money in a 401k program if you don't have anything in the bank to get you through unexpected expenses. So number two would be having emergency fund. Number three, pay down debt. You don't want to have credit card debt where you're paying anywhere from 12, 15, 16, all the way over 20%. Number four, have a savings and investment plan. As I mentioned, if you start out assuming that you get out of college, you're going to have 45 years of your working career, you only need to save $300 a month, of which $150 could probably come from your employer, $90 from tax savings. So really, net-net, it's only costing you $60. So have a savings and investment plan. And number five, this is not only key to success, it's also key to marriages, is communication, where both husband and wife discuss and participate in these financial discussions, where each side is given weight to the other's opinions and goals. You may be totally different people. One person may be the more aggressive investor. One may be more conservative. One may have different priorities in terms of savings goals. So I think communication is a real big part, John, of financial success.
Biggest thing you can do is to, number one, make a resolution. Two, have a plan. Three, have a budget. Have a budget.
I love that.
Plan, budget, and I don't know if we forgot anything there. And stick to it. And you may have to make modifications in it as the years go by, but at least you have a framework from which to work. Now, what we always do on this part of the program is take the facts we have just discussed and present a case study based on real life in which the names of the people involved have been changed to protect their privacy. So our case study today, Matt and Deborah Stern. There we go.
You know, this is an interesting case because this is a situation where the individuals have been clients of ours for well over decades. And I'm going to call this the case of Matt and Deborah Stein. Matt was a cardiologist. I met him in 1985 through his father. We managed his father's investment portfolio, and we also set up his father's retirement plan, which included an estate plan, wills, and trust. And so Matt was in a group practice when I met him back in 1985. He was making good money. He was referred to me by his father. Now, the doctor's practice had made a bunch of bad investments. That was back, John, in the days of tax shelters. Gosh, I remember you could buy a tax shelter in December and zero out all your taxes with the tax shelter. We used to call those the good old days. That ended with tax reform. And also, by the way, which brought in the alternative minimum tax, which is really getting more middle class people today than anything else. But anyway, they had made some bad investments in tax shelters, didn't want to make the same mistakes again. And so what he wanted was a financial blueprint. He recognized, look, I've got a lot of things. I'm a doctor, I'm making good money, I've got tax issues, but there's things that I have. And he had three kids, two girls, one son. And his goals were, wanted to make sure that his children would go to college. He had weddings he was going to have to pay for, bar mitzvahs he was going to have to pay for, and at the very end of the list was retirement. Obviously, early on in his career, the furthest away in terms of meeting goals and objectives was a retirement plan, because he figured, you know, he had life insurance in case something happened to him. But his immediate goals, when you start a family, you start thinking, okay, I went to college. My dad helped me through college. I want to help my kids. I've got bar mitzvahs. I got two daughters. I'm going to have to pay for the wedding. So that was why we had to prioritize those goals and set up, all right, you only have so much you can save. Let's use some tax advantages. Obviously, a pension program would help in that because the government was going to pick up part of the cost. And then basically, all right, let's prioritize. First bar mitzvahs, then college, then weddings, and then retirement.
Yeah, this is a dilemma, like we discussed earlier, that young couples, when they start out, because they are starting out, they want to have a certain level of income and living comfort, and they begin to have children, there just seem to be a whole stack of other priorities ahead of that, so they don't think about retirement. That for them is far off.
You know, it is, because most young families, you know, what does a young family probably think of? Well, today they're probably trying to pay down student loans, but most of it is going to be, hey, we want to own our own home someday, move out of an apartment. Although it's interesting, John, Generation Y and a lot of the millennials are opting to rent now, which is kind of different. And rather than live in suburbia, they're living in suburban surroundings. So, but you know, you do have different priorities starting out. Home, college, retirement. And what is really important is to prioritize those goals, which is what we did with Matt and Deborah, because we said, all right, we definitely wanted to put some money aside in a retirement plan because he got a tax deduction for doing it. And in his bracket, you know, prior to the tax reform that came into place in 1986, the highest income tax rates were 50% on the federal side. And of course, here in California, it was 9.3. So, I mean, you're talking about almost 50% tax rates back in the early 80s. So we wanted to set aside money for retirement. But, you know, the immediate things would be, because of age of his kids, would be the bar mitzvahs. Then it was going to be college. Then it was going to be weddings. And so what we did is took what he had in savings and we had to prioritize. First goal was put aside some money for bar mitzvahs. Once we had that money put aside in savings, and we did that in liquid assets, then it would check off. And that, folks, was back in the days in the 80s when you could get double digits at the bank. And then once we had that, we worked on putting so much aside from college, and they had some extra income that they had in the practice from some outside consulting that they were doing. And so some of that income was put aside, used to fund college education. He already had a nice home, so that wasn't a situation we had to deal with. So the priorities began first with the bar mitzvah, then college, and wedding for the two daughters. And mainly what we did here is the savings for retirement, initially at first, in the early age, was a retirement plan, mainly the group's profit sharing plan and personal IRAs for both Matt and Deborah.
Well, you know, Jim, you said he'd been a client since 1985, which, judging from the space and time since then, he would be close to retirement. How did that all work out?
Well, you know, it was interesting because obviously the first part of the plan was to fund the immediate needs for the family. I mean, that's what parents do. You have kids, you start thinking about those kids. In his case, it was college, it was weddings, it was bar mitzvahs. And, you know, he was already participating in a profit sharing plan that was already set up. And you also have to think about back then, and this will put this in perspective of how things have changed. Back then, he was making roughly about $140,000, $150,000 a year. And his goal was, he told me, he said, Jim, when I retire, I'd like to have $1 million in assets, whether it's my pension or personal assets that I can live on. Back then, you could get 14% at the bank or Ginnie Mae. So he's thinking $1 million at 14%, I make basically what I'm making as a doctor. And so Matt's retirement goals was to have $1 million at retirement. Now, at 12 and 13%, that was logical. And fortunately, by the time he retired, we had more than that. We had almost $1.3 million in a pension. And then we had $260,000 in an IRA. He had roughly about $500,000 in a trust investments, because obviously as his income grew, he began funding. And especially after the kids grew up, we took care of college and the other needs. He was able to start investing personally, roughly about $50,000 in money market funds, mainly at the bank. And his wife's IRA was roughly $50,000. They had a home, which was $500,000. They sold the big home, by the way, when the kids moved out, downsized, and had a free and clear home. And so the one thing that they did is when they sold their home, that freed up more assets for investing. So, you know, the one thing is, by starting out early, which he did, by prioritizing what his goals were, which he did, he achieved each and every one of them. And as one goal was checked off, that freed up savings to go to other goals like college or weddings. Once those goals were checked off, what happened then is then we began to accelerate not only investing in his profit sharing plan, we began to invest personally. And so that way, he not only had a retirement plan, which he had in IRAs, but he also had personal investments as well.
Well, from what you're saying, it seems like he was able to achieve those goals. What's the key?
You know, I think the key here was remaining disciplined. We had a plan. We modified it over the years as circumstances and as markets changed. And not only that, he had the discipline to stick to it. We moderated the plan because obviously we saw economic changes. I mean, gosh, the great bull market of the 90s, it seemed like you didn't even have to save. The market went up 1995 to 2000. The market was going up double digits each year. But he never said to himself, oh, gosh, the stock market's going up 15, 20% a year. I'll pull back on my savings. He stuck to the plan, continued his savings. Not only was he funding his pension plan, but he was also funding his personal investments.
It seems here then that number one, he had a plan, and that number two, he stuck to it. Doing the plan was the hard part, and then sticking to the plan. And as a result of having the plan, that provides a reference point. He was able to make lifestyle adjustments to enable him to comply with it.
A couple other things too, because by having a plan that not only set him apart, but also taking a long-term view when it came to his investment portfolio. He was with me during the 87 stock market crash, the 91 Gulf War recession, the tech mania, the bursting of the tech bubble, the 2008-2009 crash. And obviously we've adjusted his portfolio over the years as he's gotten older. And you know, he stuck with the asset plan. We've modified it over the years as he aged, but he didn't panic because he knew he had been in the markets long enough with us, and he was disciplined enough that he didn't panic. He had a plan. He knew that, for example, as he got older and started investing personally because of his tax bracket, he had a laddered municipal bond portfolio, so he didn't have all his eggs in one basket. John, having a plan and discipline were two of the key things here that made this a success story.
Okay, so he did all of that. He's in retirement. How's he enjoying the retirement? Is it working?
You know, it was interesting. When Matt retired at age 65, he wanted to wait an extra year to get full Social Security benefits. And actually, he still wanted to work part-time. And one of the things that he did is he had a lot of hobbies, golf, played bridge, loved to travel. And so he said, you know what? I'm still young enough. I still have the energy. Obviously, he pulled out of the partnership practice and he found another practice that wanted somebody just part-time. They didn't need a full-time doctor. So he actually worked to age 70. And at 70 and a half, he had to take mandatory distributions from his retirement plan. And that was a key thing. Here was a guy that basically said, you know, I have enough. In fact, instead of roughly $1 million at retirement, he had $2.5 million at retirement. So the plan worked out better than they thought. But with financial repression, obviously, you know, you're not getting the 14% returns that we were talking about when I first met him back in 1985. But you know what? He's enjoying retirement. He does a lot of traveling now. That's where he's spending most of his time because he has one daughter that lives overseas because her husband works for one of the big major oil companies. So that's what he's doing. So he's enjoying retirement now, but now he is fully retired and enjoying life.
It would seem like this is a success story because he started early. He had multiple goals within the family, but he was able to balance them all and then arrived at his goals because of that. And he's in retirement now. By the way, what about his kids?
I'm really proud about this because we've done financial plans for two of the three kids. And so this is the third generation of planning. So he instilled that in all of his kids about savings, financial discipline. And he related to him. He goes, look what my dad did for me. I was able to go through medical school and get out of medical school with no debt. I mean, think of how many doctors would like to be in that situation. Secondly, you know, he took care of the bar mitzvahs. He took care of the weddings were paid for. College education was paid for. And that was all done with having a plan. So that's why his kids, two of his kids right now, and we hope to get the third.
So, happy story. Let's move on to our guest right now and see if we can create more happy stories for more listeners. Attorney Elizabeth McCoy, Special Needs Trusts as Lifetime Income Continues at FinancialSense.com.
You know, as parents and sometimes grandparents, there's different situations that we have with children. We may have children that are disabled, incapacitated, or let's say you have children that may not be financially responsible. Joining us on the program is attorney Elizabeth McCoy. And Elizabeth, I want to talk about special needs that sometimes either parents or grandparents may find either with siblings or with children. Let's talk about what special needs are and what they usually entail. In other words, is it incapacity? Is it a financial issue? Define that for me, if you would.
That's a good question, because special needs is defined by law in the probate code in California. It's also defined by Social Security Administration. And so not everyone qualifies for a special needs trust. You have to have a defined disability in at least one of those two entities. And that normally would be any physical disability that started during childhood and or a mental disability. But, you know, autism, mental retardation, which is called intellectual disability now, Down syndrome, all those are defined disabilities, and those persons qualify for special needs trusts.
When you talk about a special needs trust, how does that differ from, let's say, a living trust? Let's say that I'm a husband and wife, we're married, we have three children, one of those child has autism or some kind of physical incapacity. Could I not just, through my trust, say that, you know, I want to set aside X amount of dollars to take care of this particular child? Can you do it that way? Or what does the special needs trust do that's different than, let's say, a regular trust?
Well, the main reason that people set up living trusts, our regular living trust, either a single person or a married couple, is to avoid probate, because probate is very expensive and time consuming. It can take 1 to 3 years. The cost of probate is 4.5% of the gross assets. So the probate court doesn't subtract mortgages, liens, or anything else and figure out exactly how much the equity is in the home or any other asset. They just add up the gross value of all the assets, and 4.5% of that is the cost of probate. So a lot of families are looking at $25,000 to $55,000 to $100,000 just to go through probate court, which can be completely avoided if the family has a living trust. A special needs trust, on the other hand, must be set up, and it enables the person to qualify for means-tested public benefits. So if a family just left their inheritance for that child to them directly, then all that money would be counted by the Social Security Administration, and the child with the disability or special needs would never qualify for means-tested public benefits because they would have too many assets. But a special needs trust holds those assets, that money's never counted, and it means that the person can always qualify for means-tested public benefits. But the main reason, and really the threshold reason, that parents need to consider a special needs trust is whether or not that child can manage their assets and resist fraud and undue influence. Because if they can't resist fraud and undue influence, the inheritance will be stolen, and the child will be left living off only means-tested public benefits, which is 2/3 poverty level, and no parent wants that.
Yeah, because, you know, a lot of times there are situations where parents may have considerable wealth, and all of a sudden that wealth is bestowed on the children through inheritance, not even talking about those that have disability, either physical or mental. They may not be equipped to handle the amount of wealth or be familiar with financial management.
Right. In those cases where someone might not necessarily qualify for a special needs trust, it is better to put the inheritance into a spendthrift trust or in some other vehicle where either the money is portioned out to the person or under the control of a trustee. If there's some kind of, sometimes it's a drug, alcohol abuse, or just inability to manage money. So the parents can make sure that that money will last 20, 30, 40 years down the road for their child.
And when you talk about these special needs in qualifying for public benefits, you know, Elizabeth, can you talk about the kind of benefits that are available for, let's say, the parents that do have children with special needs?
Sure. When a child turns 18, 1 minute after midnight on the 18th birthday, the child's assets are counted only as the amount of resources that the child has. So then the parents' assets are never counted. And then if the child doesn't own anything at 18 years old, then they qualify for means-tested public benefits, and they also have a defined disability. And the means-tested public benefits are Medicaid, which is administered in California as Medi-Cal, and supplemental security income. And those two different benefits will ensure that they have housing and money for food. The only problem is that those amounts only add up to 2/3 poverty level. So it's not really enough money to live off, but it does supplement. And also the Medi-Cal will pay for medical insurance and things like that. So the parents need to supplement that money somehow, because at $700, typical SSI payment, about $700 a month in California, a child can't really even get housing, much less pay for housing and food and shelter. So the SSI payments are for food and shelter, and then the Medi-Cal is for the medical expenses. But everything else in the person's life has to be paid for through some other vehicle.
So the total benefit between, let's say, Medi-Cal and, you said, two-thirds of poverty level. So what does that add up to on a yearly basis?
Most people who receive SSI, Supplemental Security Income, receive about $8,000 a year.
Okay, so $8,000 a year?
Right. An average cost of an apartment in Orange, L.A., and San Diego County for a one-bedroom apartment is about $1,000. So that doesn't even pay really for shelter.
But nonetheless, that's $8,000 that's available to a parent to help assist that is available in the public benefit realm.
Right. So most parents do seek that. And even parents who have substantial assets still apply for SSI for their child. And they still have a special needs trust to ensure that they are eligible for those benefits, because we just don't know what can happen to our assets during our lifetimes. You know, if we'll be involved in litigation or our own medical expenses would be severe enough that they would drain those assets.
And what are some of the other things that go along with the special needs trust? I assume that you're going to have some kind of successor trustee or somebody with financial knowledge, like a bank trust department. What are the rules regarding that?
It's just really defined by the terms of the trust. So parents really need to make sure that they're at an attorney who knows how to correctly draft special needs trusts, and they've only been recognized by federal law since 1993, so they're still in their infancy as far as, you know, the law. But the terms of the trust control as far as what the trustee can pay for, whether they can do in-kind support and maintenance, which means that they use the trust assets to pay for food and shelter and lose a little bit of SSI, which usually is only around $220 a month, and then the child can live in a very nice place. So they can use the assets for any of the child's special needs, which is basically anything besides food and shelter, and they can do food and shelter through in-kind support and maintenance. But most of the children will need therapies, other communicative devices, you know, all kinds of things.
I talked about a trustee, and that's defined within the document itself. Normally, Elizabeth, do you see something like a corporate trustee, or do you see situations where parents name a family member? And I want to talk about maybe some of the problems that maybe run up with the family member.
Yeah, most people who are mid to upper middle class will name family members because they have successful family members who are CPAs, doctors, lawyers themselves, and are capable of handling, you know, the job as trustee of a special needs trust. But a lot of other, especially when the wealth of the family is higher, they will name a corporate trustee or a private fiduciary, and both of those are candidates. And some of the problems with naming a bank or other financial institution is that there's a minimum as far as the asset level of the special needs trust before they will consider administering it. But the costs are about the same, and the private fiduciaries can be very responsive, but they are not inexpensive. Most people who are in the middle class to upper middle class will just name that responsible person in their family and hope for the best.
When you talk about minimums, what do most trustees need? I mean, is it like a $500,000, $1 million?
It's usually at about $400,000 is a minimum for most financial institutions.
And usually the fees for that are what, 1%? Or, you know, how do they charge on something like that?
Usually it is 1%.
When you talk about these special needs trusts, and you talked about some of the things that where they're most appropriate for is where there's a physical or mental disability. And by putting assets into a physical needs trust, it's not counted in terms of qualifying for programs. How hard is it to qualify for SSI in if you have this trust? Is it a complicated process? Because I know sometimes going through government agencies or trying to get benefits from unemployment sometimes can be difficult.
Applying through the Social Security Administration for Supplemental Security Income benefits is not a simple process, and it is lengthy. And if there is a special needs trust set up, they do require that a copy of that be provided to them. And unfortunately, are not always well trained on the different types of special needs trusts. But the special needs trusts that are set up through litigation or through probate court, if the parents don't have a living trust, have to have payback provisions. So when the beneficiary dies, then the government can lien the trust for any benefits applied during the child's lifetime and then recover all of that before anything is paid to any remainder beneficiaries. But third-party special needs trust, if a family sets up a living trust and has a special needs trust, do not have to have those types of payback provisions. So there's a little bit of work. Sometimes we have to educate the Social Security Administration employees, you know, about special needs trust, but they do require a copy of it if they have already set one up. And if the child is receiving any kind of benefits at the time of the Social Security Administration review, then they have to have an accounting of all of that. So they do get involved, but they have to follow the law and recognize the federal law in that the assets are not counted as the child's or beneficiaries.
Elizabeth, when you set up this trust, do you also assist, let's say, individuals in terms of how to apply or rules or any special kind of things that you have to go through that makes it easier to qualify for, let's say, SSRI?
Well, we always recommend in any parent meeting or any consultation that as soon as a child has a diagnosis of special needs, that the parents keep less than $2,000 in assets in the name of that child. So the $2,000 is the threshold for qualifying for means-tested public benefits, and so they can only have $2,000 in countable resources, and lots of things are counted besides cash, of course. And then there are exclusions and things like that. But we try to tell the parents not to put any substantial assets into the name of the child and keep them either in a special needs trust or just not in their name at all. And so we do give them that guidance, and then by the time they get to 18, there's not assets that they have to dispose of or the Social Security Administration can count, because the Social Security Administration can look back 60 months in the look-back period. So they can count, you know, if the parents get 17 and realize they had a $10,000 cash, you know, savings account and try to get rid of it, they can still count all that money.
Let's just throw a hypothetical example out there. And let's say I'm a parent. I have three children. I have $900,000 in investable assets. So I want to leave a third. Would you do something like, let's say, two-thirds or $600,000 gets distributed through, let's say, a regular trust, and then that one-third for the special needs child gets set up in a special needs trust? Is that the way you would do it?
I do, and you know, it's very hard for parents to treat their children unequally because their natural inclination is to treat them all the same. But a child with special needs may need more of their assets, and so they may have to unequally divide those assets, you know, into two-thirds go into the special needs trust, and the other two children who are neurotypical inherit the other third, who will most likely be able to go to college and support themselves and have a good life. But the minimum that most parents will need to look at for funding a special needs trust or funding anybody to pay for their needs after their lifetime is usually about $1 million. And a lot of them accomplish that by buying life insurance. And so that their own assets are there in case, like I said, if they are consumed for some reason, you know, during the parents' lifetimes, then they always have the life insurance to fund that special needs trust.
You know, I just thought about something like that, because if you have a situation where, let's say you mentioned, you know, if you're going to take care of a child over their lifetime, certainly with today's low interest rates, $1 million, probably, as you say, could be just a minimum. I never thought about that, you know, just setting up a life insurance policy that funds the special needs trust. So when one spouse passes away, it's funded with that. And that is probably less expensive to do.
Yeah, they can do that either with a term life insurance policy or a whole life insurance policy. But the parents need to do that before they're so old that it's more expensive. But that's what I always recommend.
And could that be done? You know, I know for estate planning back in the days when the exemption was only $1 million and many estates were subject to estate taxes, we used to do things like wealth replacement trusts that were funded with, let's say, a last to die policy. So the child obviously needs the money when both spouses are gone, and I know that a last survivor policy is much less expensive than a single life.
Yes, that's a good idea. I think that most people do have that, or they have the primary beneficiary, always the spouse, and then the secondary, the special needs trust, either way. But that single policy is less expensive.
Elizabeth, have you found that sometimes, let's take an estate where, as you just mentioned, a child that has special needs, let's say somebody that has autism or some kind of disability, that it's helpful if, let's say, more of the assets are going to go to fund the needs of a child that needs that, that it's helpful if the parents explain that to the kids so the kids know that, you know, let's say that you've got three kids, you tell the other two kids who know of the disability in advance, hey, look, we need to take care of our sister or brother. So we're going to set up more of the assets to make sure that he or she's taken care of.
Yes, it's all family planning. And most of the time, the siblings of children of special needs are incredible people. So they realize that, and they realize that that person will be part of their life for a long time. And so the parents' money will offset what they have to turn around and provide for the child, because they're not usually going to leave their sibling in two-thirds poverty level lifestyle. The other thing is that if the parents have multiple children and say only one of them has special needs, when they're younger, they don't necessarily divide it up unevenly. But as they get to 9 or 10 or 12, you know, that's when the parents start to change and those numbers change, those percentages, you know, switch so that the child with special needs is taking more.
So if you are a parent, and let's say you have children, and obviously the children are at a younger age, it seems to me that, you know, I know from the cost of insurance, the older you get, the more expensive it becomes, because obviously you're closer to the end of your life. So would you recommend getting that early? So let's say you've got a couple, they're starting a family, you know, maybe after 5-10 years of starting a family, they've got 3 children, to get something like that insurance policy at an early age where it's less expensive?
Yes, absolutely. Less expensive because they're younger, and also because, you know, we all develop more medical problems as we get older.
What are the other things that somebody needs to be aware of a special needs trust, and how can it work with, let's say, a regular trust so it's not as complicated? Can you explain that?
Well, the two entities work in conjunction, and especially with Social Security Administration, they have to be very specifically worded, because the child with special needs can't have any right to revoke or demand payment or have any other rights that a beneficiary might have under a regular living trust. So for almost every family, I recommend that they have a third-party special needs trust, standalone special needs trust, and separately their own living trust to avoid probate. The fact of having a living trust will mean that their child doesn't have a first-party special needs trust in probate court someday. So it's all interrelated. You know, they have to have their own entity to take care of themselves and to provide for themselves and their minor children should they die while their children are minors. But they also need to make sure that the wording is correct so that the special needs trust actually works the way that it should after their death. And part of that wording is making sure that the inheritance is left directly to the child's special needs trust and not the child to be put into a special needs trust. So if the wording's just a little bit incorrect, then the Social Security Administration can claim, no, the person took here, inherited right here, and it has to have payback provision. So you really have to be someone knowledgeable about, you know, the language that, and the arguments the Social Security Administration can make regarding special needs trust.
Elizabeth, when you're looking at this, and let's say you find out a diagnosis of one of your children at an early age, isn't that really the time to start thinking about this, to think about a trust, maybe think about insurance, think about how that child is going to be taken care of, rather than, let's say, waiting 5-10 years later, 15 years later, where it can not only be more costly, but also what happens if something happens in a marriage? Somebody, let's say, predeceases, let's say the husband or wife gets in an accident, has a medical illness themselves. So the sooner it seems like you could get yourself focused on taking care of this issue, the better off you're going to be.
That's absolutely true. And the thing is that, you know, things can happen to us at any time. We don't know when our number's up, so to speak. But, you know, as soon as a parent has a diagnosis of that qualifying special needs, then they really need that special needs trust in place. And someday, it may be that they don't need the special needs trust, but in the meantime, you know, the child's protected because something can happen to them at any time, you know, but also they need it in conjunction with a nomination of guardian agreement and all their other trust documents that protect them. So, you know, people need durable power of attorney. So if they're laying in a hospital, they refinance, the home is out of the trust and they didn't realize it, someone can sign that deed if they're unconscious before, you know, they die and then the whole estate ends up in probate. So having all of your affairs in order is a very comforting thing, especially when you have any child, but especially when you have a child with special needs who will not be able to take care of themselves and who will not be able to protect themselves from predators.
And, you know, wouldn't it make sense to any couple starting a family, you start having children, let's say you haven't accumulated the assets, but either you have insurance policies that you've taken out to take care of the estate, or maybe you have insurance benefits from, let's say, being at work. doesn't it make a lot of sense to also have an estate plan? Because a lot of people think, well, I don't have a lot of money. You know, I don't need to worry about estate taxes. But I wonder if you might address, Elizabeth, some of the issues that come up with probate. A lot of people think they can solve that with just property titling, but also about the incapacity issues that can come about as a result of an accident that was unforeseen or just something that happens prematurely that you don't expect.
Yeah, it is important to be able to provide for the correct distribution of your assets because for some families, probate is the best way. There's no one responsible in that family enough to settle that estate. But for most families who have enough assets to qualify, you know, they have more than $100,000 and they own real property. They have brothers and sisters and parents who are responsible enough who can act as trustees of their trust. But there's an old saying in estate planning, where there's a will, there's a probate. And a will will not avoid probate. So parents need to have a living trust so that they won't give $45,000 to $100,000 to an attorney or to the courts, and that money can go to their children instead as a result of that living trust. But that planning is important to make sure that your money is not spent on taxes, on attorneys, on the courts, and can just be settled out of court and provide the most support for your children that you leave behind you.
So the basic documents, Elizabeth, that you would recommend any couple that, let's say, gets married and starts having children, what would they be?
Well, if a family is renting and doesn't own real property yet, then they usually just need a will. If they have a minor child, I would meet them at the hospital with a nomination of guardian agreement if I could, because if the family doesn't have a nomination of guardian agreement for that minor child, then the state is the default guardian, and the state can come in and seize their child if they're incapacitated or they die. So just if they're in the hospital, the state can put the child in state-sponsored foster care. And most parents don't want that. Parents of children with special needs who have very, very specific diet and other needs would never sleep at night, you know, with that a possibility. So they need wills. They need a nomination of guardian agreement if they have a child under the age of 18. And that nomination of guardian agreement completely avoids probate court proceeding naming a guardian. You can't sell a baby or contract away rights, but you can give all the rights you have as a parent of a minor under the law in a nomination of guardian agreement to another person. So you just have that written agreement, and that person can designate schooling, make all medical decisions, housing decisions, and any other right you had as a parent of a minor child until the child's 18. So that's important. So will, nomination of guardian agreement, every person who is an adult needs a durable power of attorney for asset management, and that names an attorney in fact so that that person can sign upon your incapacity. Because we just don't know what we may have out there. We're incapacitated. That needs to be signed, anything from your tax return to some other designation or agreement or anything else, or a deed. You also need to have a healthcare directive. Every person who's an adult should have one of these signed, and that sets forth your healthcare agent who can make all healthcare decisions about you without having to go to court. And under HIPAA, if it doesn't have HIPAA provisions, they can't even look at your computer screen or make any medical decisions for another adult without that healthcare directive. And then once the family or a person has more than $100,000 in countable resources that would cause probate, so that's real property and bank accounts and things like that, then they should have a living trust to avoid probate. So those are the major documents, wills, possibly living trust once they're over that $100,000 threshold, or they own real property, the nomination of guardian agreement, durable power of attorneys, and health care directives. And then if they have a child with special needs, as soon as they have that diagnosis, they should set up a special needs trust to protect that child.
All right. Well, listen, Elizabeth, if our listeners would like to find out more information about special needs trust or things like you just mentioned, a guardian agreement, how could they do so? And if, let's say, they would like to contact you regarding your services on special needs, is there a number or a website they can go to?
Sure. My website is www.ca-special-needs-trust-com. And my telephone number is 760-723-8906.
Well, listen, Elizabeth, thanks so much for joining us on the program. We appreciate all the information that you brought to today's show. And hopefully, for those parents that have been struggling or thinking about these special needs, they will find this helpful. All the best to you.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, that concludes this week's show. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on our first program of the year on Lifetime Income. And folks, if you're in one of those special situations that you have a child that has special needs, you know, hopefully you will find this helpful and you will take steps to protect that child. And if you're a new family starting out having kids, really get together and get that guardian agreement. I mean, imagine what would happen if something happened to you tragically, something happened in childbirth, or let's say you got in an accident or something. Do you really want the state deciding who takes care of your children? So hopefully you'll find today's program, we've had a lot of requests for this kind of thing, and hopefully you'll find this valuable. In the meantime, well, we've run out of time. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the program. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.